Good evening.
Welcome tonight. Thank you for being here. My name is Erica Bridgman. I'm a longtime engineer, producer, and host at KPFA Radio. Edgewich Dondicott was born in Haiti and came to the United States when she was 12 years old. She graduated from Barnard College and received an MFA from Brown University. She is the author of numerous books, including Brother, I'm Dying, a National Book Critics Circle Award, and National Book Award finalist, Breath, Eyes, Memory, an Oprah Book Club selection, Crick Crack, a National Book Award finalist, The Farming of Bones, an American Book Award winner, and The Dew Breakers, a Penn Faulkner Award finalist and winner of the inaugural Story Prize. The recipient of a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, she has been published in The New Yorker and The New York Times and elsewhere. Tonight, she is here to share her most recent work, Claire of the Sea Light. It is truly an honor to introduce to you Edgewich Dondicott.
Bonsoir. Gemun Lakaila. This seems like there are people from home here. Thank you. Thank you, Erica. Thank you, KPFA. Thank you to the Bay Area Haitian community and to all of you for coming tonight. It's nice to be back, and I always feel like I get such a kind welcome here. I was practically living at KPFA this afternoon. I was on many different programs. We talked many things. So whatever we didn't get to at the station this afternoon, we'll get to tonight, I hope. So I'm speaking on this Janet Jackson mic, so I'm going to move this aside. So I think the way we're going to do it, I'm going to talk and read a little bit from Claire of the Sea Light, and then we'll have a talk and conversation here on the stage with your question, and I think some of Erica's question too. So Claire of the Sea Light is initially, when I started this book, I thought, so this is fitting that it's KPFA, right? I thought I was writing a book about the radio. I wanted to write a novel that was like a radio show in which each chapter was an episode of this radio show. And so in my mind, this radio show would be called Dis-moi, Tell Me, and the hostess was a woman named Louise George. And Louise is kind of a recluse in this small town, but her passion is the radio, and her passion is using the radio for justice. So on Dis-moi, Louise's show, people come in who have been wronged by different others in the town, and then they tell their story, and then the next week someone else comes and tells their story. So since there's really no justice through the courts, so Louise gives herself the task of making justice for people through this radio show. And I've had many friends who worked on the radio in Haiti, and it's a medium that is a very powerful medium in Haiti. When I was growing up, where I lived, even if we didn't have your radio on in the house, you would hear other people's radio in the neighborhood. And to this day, when I'm in Haiti, mostly in the countryside where my mother-in-law has her house, if we go 2 or 3 days, we start wondering, hey, what's happening in the rest of the world? The way we find out is we turn on the radio. So my goal was to write this book about the radio. And then it wasn't coming together just how I envision. Sometimes it doesn't for fiction or writing in general. And then I was watching a documentary about orphanages in Haiti, where people who are still, you know, parents will sometimes bring their children to an orphanage, not because they don't love them, but because they feel like they can't take care of them. So they'll bring a child to an orphanage, and sometimes they'll visit them when they bring them a little something when they have it. And one of the people in the documentary said something like, you know, they do this because they're not as attached to their children. And then, you know, it's one of those things where you can get angry, but you can also get creative angry. So I felt like I got creative angry, and then Claire came, this little girl Luminous, whose father, Nosias, is a poor fisherman, is in the middle of trying to make this choice of whether to keep her with him or give her away to this other better off woman in town named Madame Gael. And the interesting thing in that choice is too that I think often when it comes to children in Haiti and sort of the ways that sometimes they're used or misused, we often hear about a very difficult and tragic situation of domestic servitude, the Reste Avec system, but also less talked about, it's this other, the counter to that is where people take in other people's children as their own, where people are, you know, where what the family is very extensive, and that, for example, I was raised by my aunt and uncle from the time that I was 4 to the time that I was 12, while my parents were working here, and I grew up in a house full of children like me, and so they took us, you know, they took us in because a family is not just your mother, your father, your brother, your sister. It's as extended as you can imagine, and sometimes as extended as you can make it. So Claire's father is sort of operating with that belief where he thinks that he's a poor fisherman. He might go out to sea one day and disappear, and he wants to have someone else who can look after his daughter. So Claire doesn't quite understand the decision, and so the night that the book starts, she disappears. And Claire's mother died in childbirth, which is why he is making that decision. So the book takes place all in one night, and it's one night where everybody is at the beach because there's been a woke wave that morning, and a fisherman has died. So the community is gathering in a wake around the wife of this fisherman. And all these things are playing out, including you meet different people in the town. The book jumps back and forth to different people in this town called Ville Rose. And so you meet different people. And I'd always imagine this book, the reader, the role of this reader in the book as someone who just happens to wander on the beach that night and while this is happening. And you, the reader, you wander into all this and you overhear gossip and snippets of conversation and sort of what people are saying about people, and you try to put together for yourself how they are related. Because I and as a reader, and I'm first a reader before I'm a writer, like a kind of participatory reading experience myself. I like to feel like the writer left a little work for me to do. And so the book is trying to do some of that. So people often ask, is it a novel? Is it short stories? And I think of it as something in between, a kind of hybrid of both those things. And I kind of resisted doing it that way because I had done a book that had a similar structure and the Dew Breaker, and I didn't want people to say, oh, is this the only way this woman knows how to write book-length fiction? You know, so, but this is what the book wanted to be. And the town, Ville Rose, is, my mother's name is Rose, and Ville Rose is based on the town where my mother was born and grew up, and in the time where I would, in the summer, visit my very formal grandmother, who's my mother's mother, and it was a, you know, it was a very modest, but very strict household, and we would, you know, you would sit there and eat at the table, and then after, in the afternoon we would go to the beach to down the road in en masse with the other cousins, and I remember those visits. Always, almost always, someone would nearly drown. There was always a near drowning when we visit Grandmère's house, and their cousins. We always sing, and there's this, even now when we're grown up, they're like, "Do you remember when you saved my life? Do you remember that time when you saved my life?" We all saved each other's lives at some point. So Ville Rose is based on that town and other coastal towns that I have been on in Haiti over the years. So we're going to go on a brief journey to Ville Rose. As I said, imagine yourself on the beach, and I'll read two short sections. And the first one involves a young man named Max Jr. So Max Jr. is the son of Max Sr., who is one of the wealthy men in the town. He owns a private school, and Max Jr. had raped and impregnated a woman who was working for his family, a young woman, and so his father sent him away and sort of tried to, they sent him away so the word wouldn't get out, and then so Max Jr. 10 years later comes back to meet his son and also to face some of, you know, some of this himself. And so the sea plays a big role in the book. Of course, you know, Haiti is on an island, but the sea means so much to us in terms of even how we got there in the first place, the Middle Passage, and then the reverse Middle Passage for a lot of us as Haitians, which is this issue of, you know, of boat people who are going the opposite way. God knows, I wrote a story called Children of the Sea, in which I try to imagine those spirits meeting, those who are coming from the Middle Passage and those who are leaving, trying to get to Miami. So the sea is very important in this book, both as a story and a place of personal escape, but also a place of stories and mythology. And stories also play a big role in the book. So we'll start with Max Jr. and at sea. Now, as he walked fully clothed to the water, Max Jr. thought of his father's version of a Cornish folktale, one the old man had told him when he was a little boy. The story goes that a boy is lured into the woods by music. The deeper the boy walks into the woods, the denser the woods become, and the more beautiful the music. The boy follows this music until he gets so lost that he no longer knows where he is. He becomes so scared that he wants to return home, but he also wants to follow the music and see where it leads. After he walks so far that the woods become impassable, he begins to cry for help, and that's when a spirit emerges and makes a path for him. The path leads to the sea, where suddenly the music stops, and the boy is now so tired that he lies down and falls asleep. When he wakes up, the boy finds himself back home, safely in his own bed, with his head full of music and mermaids and crystal palaces under the sea. The spirit in the woods saved this boy, Max's father said, because the spirit wanted the boy to remain innocent and good, and that innocent and that goodness was as precious as the dreams that the spirit had placed in his head. And because of that innocence and that goodness, that spirit would watch over this boy forever. Max Jr. now slipped into the water, feeling the cool waves rise and fall around him as the water ballooned his red shirt. And the sea, he thought of music, the rap-filled kind he has once played on his radio show. He also thought of flowers and birds. He thought of the birdhouses he and his father had built together after hours of schoolwork and judo practice when he was a boy. He thought of the somber plumage of seagulls. He thought of pigeons alive and dead in his father's stories. He thought of the orchids and roses in his father's garden, the dragonflies that buzzed around after a heavy rain, and the fireflies that bombarded them at night. He thought of yellow jasmine, his mother's favorite flowers. She would tie a bouquet to the bell on the front of her bicycle. Then the two of them would ride to town. They would ride through the Clairin factory, and his mother, sniffing the air, would become giddy from the raw liquor smell. He thought of his mother's history lessons about the ruins in town. He remembered the talk they had had in the middle of the ruins shortly before his mother had left town. "You are who you love," she had told him. You try to mend what you have torn. You remember that love is like kerosene. The more you have, the more you burn. He liked his mother's aphorisms. He also liked how she tried to explain the rogue waves. The goddess La Sirène, she said, made her presence known by swelling a wave several feet whenever she craved human company. One night, 10 years ago, after he learned that Flore was pregnant with his child, he was sitting on the gallery of the old lighthouse when he thought he saw a supernova exploding above the sea. He had wondered then whether he was in shock or hallucinating or overtired, but now he believed that he had neither dreamed nor imagined this. It had actually happened. He was remembering this, he knew, as a way of avoiding thinking about his son. He imagined the old face drawing melting, coming apart even in, now in his pants pocket, the one his son has made for him, a drawing made by the son whom he just met, his son whom he might never see again. Would meeting him today have meant anything at all to his son? How long would it take the boy to forget him? Would his son grow up calling another man Papa? And if he did, would there ever be some hesitation, a hint of doubt in the back of the boy's mind, something that would ring false in the sound of the boy's voice? The worst possible case of unrequited love, his father had told him, was feeling rejected by a parent, was the second worst, being rejected by your child. He knew quite a bit about unrequited love. Until he had met his son, he'd felt as if every other love were a faint phantom version, a shadow of the one he'd never have. People like to say of the sea that la mer pas qu'un bécasse, the sea does not hide dirt, it does not keep secrets. The sea was both hostile and docile, the ultimate trickster. It was as large as it was small, as long as you could claim a portion of it for yourself. You could scatter both ashes and flowers in it. You could take as much as you wanted from it, but it too could take back. You could make love in it, and you could surrender to it. And oddly enough, surrendering at sea felt somewhat like surrendering on land, taking a deep breath and simply letting go. You could just as easily lie down in the sea as you might in the woods and simply fall asleep. So the second section I'll read before the conversation is about Madame Gaël. So Madame Gaël too is on the beach that night with you all. And she decides that night, Claire's father has been trying for as long as Claire has been alive to convince Madame Gaël to take Claire, because Madame Gaël had lost her husband in a gang shooting. She'd lost her daughter in an accident. So Claire's father decides that Madame Gaël having Claire will fill a hole for both of them. Claire will get a mother, Madame Gaël will get a child. So on Claire's 7th birthday, which is the night of the story, Madame Gaël makes up her mind and she decides that she will take Claire. And so she goes to the beach that night with that intention. And we also find out through this decision process for Madame Gaël why she doesn't leave Villerose. She's decided, she's been torn about it, whether she wants to stay because of all her losses. At that night she decides that she's going to stay and she's going to start her life over with Claire. But then it gets complicated because then Claire goes missing and you have to read the book to find out what happens. but before Claire goes missing, she and Madame Gaël have a chance to have a face-to-face. Now, the structure of this book, also I talked a little bit about it before, but the book, it goes in a circular way around this one evening. And one of the models for that is something called the WON. And the Haitians here know that the WON is sort of, it's like a ring around the rosy game and little girls holding hands and singing, and Claire loves the WON. And when I was writing this book, I always feel like every book has a godparent, like a parent, we would say. And the godfather of this book was Jean Toomer, and the book was Cain. And it's sort of novel and stories and poems. And when you read a book like that, and when you're writing a book like this, you feel like that book gives you permission to try different things. And so in Cain, there's a lot of poems that to me felt like songs. And so I felt like I could use the WON in this kind of way. So Madame Gaëlle has arrived now on the beach, and she and Claire are finally talking about this decision that she has made. When Madame Gaëlle finally made it to the beach, she spotted a group of little girls. They were holding one another's hands and moving clockwise in a circle, a singing circle, a WON. Madame Gaëlle was too far away to hear what the little girls were singing, but she could hear their laughter, each girl, it seemed, trying very hard to outdo the next. They seemed to be the happiest people on the beach, six little brown and black angels skipping around fallen sea hearts. Madame Gaëlle moved slowly, not wanting the pleasure of her approach to end. She too had played the WON as a child, during recess at school and at night in her parents' yard with visiting friends. What she remembered most about the WON, though, was how less lonely she always felt holding someone else's hand. It would have sounded odd if she told someone at that moment how much she wanted to take all these little girls home, set them up in the many empty rooms of her large house, and whenever she was sad, ask them to play the WON with her. There were many days when she wanted to grab a little girl off the street and hold her in her arms just to inhale her smell, the smell that the man she slept with lacked. Their smells were musty. They smelled of roads and dust and cologne that never quite covered their musk. They smelled of work, of sweat, of other women. But little girls smelled of roses and jasmine and wet leaves and talcum powder and the dew. In spite of what everyone had told her, losing her daughter had not made her strong. It had made her weak. Her longings like this had never subsided, and her losses had made her weak. They had given others control and power over her. She didn't want to continue being weak, but she didn't want to die either. She was too eager to see what would come next, what her husband and daughter had missed. She was both hungry for life and terrified of it. Her evenings with the men she slept with let her rage and confusion disappear for a while and allowed her for a minute to make it through. These days, these men allowed her to sell thread and cloth, and staying in Villerose allowed her to remain close to the graves of the people she really loved. There were times, though, that she wanted to leave Villerose, leave the country, and never come back. But she had heard too much about the difficulties of starting a new life in another land to even want to try. She had heard about people who had been infantilized while learning a new language, people who ended up cleaning houses or wiping the asses of other people's children. She saw these people return to Villerose at Christmas or in the summer with extravagant hairstyles and expensive-looking clothes, but their eyes always, always betrayed them. All the humiliation they had endured could be detected there. Their skins betrayed them too. The burns from the dry cleaner steamer or the car wash or the restaurant kitchens, as visible as brands on animals. No, none of that was for her. Her ancestors on both sides were buried at the town cemetery among the town's oldest families. She could not be diaspora. She liked her ghost nearby. She could never live in a foreign land, then return only a few times a year. She could never risk dying and being buried in a cold place. She would always be here, she thought, like the boulder that stopped her feet when at last she reached the little girls. One of the girls, Claire, realized that she was being watched and occasionally glanced her way. Like her mother, Claire was beautiful. She moved more gracefully, more purposefully than the rest of the girls, even the ones who were older. Madame Gaëlle walked over to the girls, and immediately her presence stopped the game. "Is your father here?" she asked Claire. The girl nodded. She was looking down at her hands, then at her sand-coated feet. Impatient, the other girls lost interest and drifted away. Claire's eyes seemed to light up the way children's light do when they're hungry for stories. "I knew your mother," Madame Gaëlle said. "I knew her longer than you have been alive. Your mother was my friend." It was not altogether a lie. The girl's head was arched towards her now, her mouth wide open as though to inhale Madame Gaëlle's words, which came out so fast that she could barely stop. Madame Gaëlle was not sure what she was thinking and what she was actually saying out loud. "When your mother was pregnant with you," she began, "your mother gave up washing and dressing the dead. Then she had all the time to do nothing but go out on the water with your father. And so she waited so long to have you, your mother. She waited so long to have you. I wouldn't even say wait. She tried, she tried, she tried. She tried to pull you out of the sky, pry you out of God's hands. Yes, God's hands, I say. I don't go to church every Sunday. I don't go to church at all. But she wanted you so bad. I know she pulled you out of God's hands. That's the only way I can put it. She was well the whole time you were inside her body. Never even seemed tired when she came into the shop, except the last week when she didn't come. Then the midwife was sent for. No one knows what happened while you were being born. I hear the midwife thought all was going well. You should not blame yourself for her dying while you were being born. That Revena talk, the Revena that they call children like you, that is superstition. Nobody returns. There is no Revena. That is not real. You are gone and you are gone forever, back in God's hands, and no one can pull you back. Not you, not you, Claire. I hope you understand. Not you, back in God's hands, but your mother and my husband and my daughter and everyone else who has died, who didn't deserve to die, back in God's hands. The who deserves to die, the who deserves to die. Too many people die here. And why do the rest of us get to live? Thank you.
The book was so, when I read it, it was like I was going into another world. And one of the things that struck me the most was how much fairy tales, as you were saying, and I was wondering if you could say something about using fairy tales or stories and how that came about being part of the overall story.
Well, I like to use stories. I think it's because, in part, I come out of a household of storytellers. Mm-hmm. I come out of a storytelling tradition. So I feel like oral storytellers, were my first writing teachers in sort mm-hmm. of structure. So I like to reproduce that and use stories. But this was a little bit even easier in terms of using stories because the story is about a child. So that also facilitated and using elements like the wand and other sort of devices like that just felt like a very natural fit, because you were dealing with sort of a child's imagination, and that made it even more possible to use these fairy tales and also think about and see ways that they have real life parallels. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, someone had pointed out to me that, for example, you have in a lot of folk tales, you have wicked stepmothers, and part of that is because you had very high maternal mortality rates, and at the time that these stories were being written. So, there's so many echoes in real life of folk tales. I mean, they were written for a reason, mm-hmm. and sometimes you are faced with a situation where you suddenly realize, oh, this is why this story came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the parallel between writing from the point of a child and then switching and then writing stories from adults who are living very challenged lives. How was going back and forth, what was that process of writing these from two very different life perspectives?
Well, it's funny, when I was inside this book, I felt like I was borrowing sort of emotionally, I guess, for the characters, both from my childhood self and my adult self. So I was both thinking from the perspective of this child and the parent. And it was, this is the first book-length fiction that I've written since I've become a mother. So I think in parts it was just really addressing, like, thinking of this situation from the perspective of Claire, but also from the perspective of her father, of being able to easily imagine how they would both feel in that situation. So it wasn't such a hard shift, because all the characters I write about them in third person. Mm-hmm. So even though it closely sort of echoes what they might feel and how they might talk, it's still there's one voice. I didn't have to do like sort of an I voice for each of them, which mm-hmm. I think would have been a lot more challenging.
Mm-hmm. I have a question here. It seems to me that several contemporary writers, like the name Claire,
actually have the name, like Claire Massoud. That's actually her name.
Is it a double entendre? That was a question. And then also, did you learn English at 12? Thank you.
I'll take the last one. I did learn English at 12. I came to the States from Haiti when I was 12, so that's when I learned English, I think that year, the first year. About the name Claire, though, I just, there are certain names that I really liked, and I thought that I thought, you know, when I have daughters, I will give them these names. So one of them was Sophie, which is the name of the main character in Breath Eyes Memory, and another one was Claire. Neither of my daughters are named Claire or Sophie, that gives me, you know, when I have like a name, I can give it to characters. It's like having more daughters. I guess, actually, someone who read the book in galleys thought it was reflecting of Saint Clara, you know, like Clara and Claire. But I just really like the name. And I think I had the name before I had the story. Like the full name of the little girl is Claire Limiel en Mer Faustin. So it's so Claire of the Sea Light, and people have teased me. They're like, there's no Haitian who's gonna name their kid Claire Limiel en Mer. And I said, oh, that's why it's fiction.
Well, that, I wanted to ask you, where did the characters come from, like, and the personal stories of the character, where did they emerge from?
Well, they emerge, they actually come from the writing. Sometimes, if you're very lucky, a character will just come fully formed with his or her own story and everything already done. But other characters you have to kind of chase around. You have to write to discover who they are. And I always think it's like people. It's like how you get to know people. You know that expression where people would say, oh, I feel like I've known her all my life. So there are characters who are like that, where you just, they come and you feel like you've known them all your life. And others, like other friendships, where you have to gradually get to know the person. And often that's by writing, you know, through the writing. And they gain layers, they gain, you know, and then they become deeper and more profound, hopefully, as you go.
Another question here. You are at the vanguard of Haitian letters in the U.S. There are also Haitian writers in Haiti and Canada. Could you tell us about them?
They're actually one of the things that that I try very hard to do is actually to make sure that people know that I am not an oddity. You know, that I come from this very, I come from this powerful oral tradition, but I also have this very extraordinary literary legacy. And so I've been involved in many projects of translation. For example, I'll talk about people that you can find, and then we'll mention some others. But for example, I was involved in translation of Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, who's one of our sort of the great forces of our literature. One of the books that I worked on the translation of called In the Flicker of an Eyelid, L'Espace d'un Cima. But another book of his that was translated was A Genial Compère Soleil, General Sun, My Brother, which deals with the massacre of Haitian cane workers and others in the Dominican Republic. Also worked on a translation of Marie Chauvet's Love, Anger, Madness, which is in the Modern Library series, which is her seminal novel. Langston Hughes, some decades back, translated Jacques Women's Masters of the Dew. And so contemporary writers who you could find in English, Yannick Lyons, Tante Gézia, and others, for which I wrote a foreword. But if you might have to wait until January, but if you want to get a sample of sort of Haitian writing, I edited an anthology called Haiti Noir, and actually Claire of the Sea Light started as a story there, but in January, we're doing Haiti Noir 2, the classics, and there'll be stories by many of the great Haitian masters in it, and more some more contemporaries like Dany Laferrière, Gigi Dominique, and Paulette Pujol, who passed away recently. So that between those two books, you can get a good sense of Haitian literature, contemporary and from the past.
Mm-hmm. Great. Let's see another question. Did you? Did you read? I'm sorry.
Do you want me to try? I have a challenging handwriting myself. So, did you read Lost City Radio by Daniel Arlacorn, another book about the role of the radio? I did, and one of my. Warm by Candlelight is one of my favorite books, the Daniel Alarcon short story selection. And so when I was thinking about the radio, I did read that book, and I thought I would never, I think that was one of the reasons that I stalled. I said I could never get close to this. It's a wonderful book.
How do the historical, political, and economic challenges of the people of Haiti inform your work? Kind of a
why are they chuckling? I'm not wearing my glasses, so I can't see faces. A great deal, of course. I don't think it's necessarily a funny question, but. It's those things are at the core of what I do. I mean, I think part of it is what drives me, and part of the work is my attempt at better understanding those things, because I come from a family that's suffered from many of those factors. Obviously, I'm here because my parents had to leave and find work, and you know, I've had ways that sort of migration and other things have caused very tragic happenings in my family. So it's part of the work is also a personal quest to better understand those things, and also to first for myself and a little bit for others, to give them some context and give them a face. You know, I think through fiction you can personalize and humanize very important things. Mm-hmm. You know, while still being engaging, while still telling a story, which is what these storytellers did. Mm-hmm. You know, they talked about very heavy things in a way, in engaging ways, and sometimes they made you laugh, sometimes they made you cry. But all of these, you know, these issues and how they affect individuals is what I try to do, especially in my fiction, understand sort of the aftermath of a dictatorship, the aftermath of certain kind of disasters, and how and what kind of imprint that they leave on individual people. And fiction gives you a very direct and sort of movement oriented way, like a very positively sort of engaging, like tell a story, and then you understand something in a way that you may not if somebody gives a speech or if you read an article. But if you read about an individual, if you sort of go deep into somebody's internal and outside struggle, all of those things can possibly, one hopes, become a lot clearer to someone who's reading it.
Right. That was one of the reasons why I loved the story of Bernard, mm-hmm. him wanting to have a radio show, as well as the woman, what is her name again?
Louise George.
Mm-hmm. Louise, who also had the radio show. You got to sense the motivation behind wanting to go on the air and to be a public voice, I felt.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one of the things that I like and Louise George and Bernard and the people, the radio people in the book, who are like radio people I have known, and that they want to, especially the ones that want to use the radio for justice, for change, they want people to come forth and tell their own story. Mm. So I worked on a film called, a documentary called The Agronomist, about Jean-Dominique, who is one of Haiti's most famous radio journalists, who was then assassinated. And one of the people we interviewed for the film was a man named Charles Suffra, who was living in the Artibonite, very far from Radio Haiti, where the radio station was in Port-au-Prince. And he walked for days to go to the radio station to talk about what was happening in the Artibonite, because he felt like if he could get his story on the radio, there would be change. And he said he was listening to the radio since he was a little boy, and he feels like that had a lot to do in him, his becoming a leader of his community, hearing the stories of struggles that were happening elsewhere. And so, I mean, people like these characters in the story, like these people that I have known, really believe in this medium, because there are not that many other ways for them to have their stories heard and to have it told in their own voices, which is also very important to them.
Yeah, yeah. Another question. What is your motivation for writing this book? If there was a message or a teaching you wanted your readers to come away with, what would it be?
It's always, you know, I feel like I want when people, I write nonfiction so that I can get my messages out that way. And so I want, in the book, I want the reader to be engaged. I want them to, you know, to get lost in the story. But I guess if there was a message, it would be about community. Because I think part of the reason that many places like this, places like Villerose, places like my grandmother's town and others, and even more remote places, part of the reason that people have survived there mm-hmm. is not because they had a government that supported them or because they had, mm-hmm. you know, they had the NGOs and all of that. It's because they had each other yeah. and they had a very powerful sense of community that was born out of the stem of Alaku, which is, you know, which is sort of one, you look, we all look after one another. I mentioned the Jacques Roman novel, Masters of the Dew, where the whole point of the novel was that this young man returns to this town and tries to keep the community, you know, in the ways that they that have been. And you know, he says there's something in the novel like where he says a line where he says, cooperation is sort of the wealth of the poor, mm-hmm. and the fact of their getting together in this community. And this community in this book, too, has a lot of tensions, like the community in that book. But ultimately, you know, when the fisherman dies, people come and try to support his wife. And that's something I think, and perhaps in the narrative of Haiti, is perhaps purposely, perhaps not, but is often lost because the savior narrative is so strong mm-hmm. that, you know, you need some big savior to come and all that it overwhelms this other reality that has maintained the country for so long. The fact that really people have had to count on one another and ultimately, that there have to be a community. So if there were a message, it would be that there is a community.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the paradoxes of the sea, docile and hostile, large and small. What paradoxes have you been speaking to lately?
Wow. What paradoxes? I have to choose a paradox. there are so many. I mean, I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, mm-hmm.
One
paradox, I guess, would be even addressing these issues from a distance, mm-hmm. A close and passionate distance, but still from a distance. And
do you mean geographic distance?
Yeah, or? I guess geographic, and also of at the same time that we're talking about community, there's also all these other struggles mm-hmm. that Haitian people in the diaspora are facing, most recently this issue in the Dominican Republic, mm-hmm. where the High Court in the Dominican Republic decided that people who have been there after 1929 cannot have citizenship unless they can prove that they have one Dominican parent. Mm-hmm. But how do you prove that you have a Dominican parent if your parent is not allowed to have been Dominican since 1929? Mm-hmm. So you have something like a quarter of a million people immediately without nationality. Mm-hmm. And so I think often the painful reality that people in our diaspora face, whether they're in the Bahamas or the Dominican Republic, I think it's that, I guess the paradox is sort of this balancing this notion of what's success, whatever it might mean to us, if it means anything, or so many of our brothers and sisters are suffering in different places like this.
Okay, so I'm reading this. I'm not sure if I understood correctly. Is Max Jr. speaking of his love for another man, for Bernard? And if so, was your goal for bringing a gay relationship into the book?
Yes, Max Jr. loves Bernard, and his family struggles with that, more his father, because it's his only son, and the town is small, and they're wrestling with that. Bringing a gay relationship, I think there's probably a gay relationship in most of my books, and I think part of it is an interest I have in seeing sort of how people who are marginalized themselves treat other people who they think are even more marginalized than them. Mm-hmm. So I've been very intrigued in following, for example, recent developments in Haiti, where there've been all these preachers who've taken to the streets to protest against homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And people think that a lot of them were driven by the missionaries, and because before it wasn't even an issue, people just went about their business, and a lot of it was integrated in a kind of play and carnival and other, mm-hmm. and a lot of the Ungans and others were there was a fluidity to it, but all of a sudden there's like this big uprising about it that nobody is quite sure where it came from, mm-hmm. but to me it's interesting to see how people, it's like if you're maligned in your own way, how you treat other people who you consider not of you, mm-hmm. and I wanted to also to write about father son relationship and these types of friction. So I think in a way Max Jr. and Bernard is sort of, there's one of the central love stories of the book.
Mm-hmm. What time period does the story take place? Is this after, or is it 2007, after or before?
Okay, that was a good guess. I had in mind 2009, and the year before the earthquake, and I had it in some drafts very precisely stated, and then I took it out because I wanted sort of an element of timelessness to it, even though the people have cell phones and everything, mm-hmm. so you can gauge the time of it. But it's 2009, the year before the earthquake, and I didn't, it's not set after the earthquake because I personally feel like I'm not ready to write about the earthquake. I lost loved ones and I lost friends, but I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like for me, if I were writing about it so close to the time, it would be competing with sort of the facts, with the reality, which is still so fresh in people's minds. So I hope it's clear that it's before the earthquake, because otherwise I think if it was set after the earthquake, it would be about the earthquake, mm-hmm. and how it affects the characters. And I also started writing the book in 2005, mm-hmm. and had a big chunk of it before the earthquake happened. So it's 2009.
How long did you take? How long did it take to write?
It took, I guess it took about 8 years, but not 8 straight years. I stopped to write my essays, the book of essays that I would create dangerously, and I had very small children at home. I have an 8 and 4-year-old, and so it probably also accounts a little bit for the fragmentation of it. but it 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 was on and off for about, I guess, about 8-9 years.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Maybe 7-8 years.
7 years. another question. In the story I'm working on for a writing workshop in Berkeley, womanhood and motherhood are very central ideas. And I thought you represented motherhood beautifully in Clare of the Sea Light. What is the most important thing to keep in mind when writing about motherhood?
The most important thing to keep in mind when writing about the motherhood is probably, I think the important thing is when writing about anything is to sort of shed the generalities, to tell yourself, not that you're writing about motherhood, because motherhood is probably different for every mother on the face of this earth, mm-hmm. but that you're writing about the singular, extraordinarily one mother whose name, to whom you will have to give a name and characteristics, and because sometimes the most particular, sort of the most singular things are the most universal. So if one sets out to write about motherhood in general, you will inevitably fail, because motherhood even in San Francisco is very different from motherhood in Manhattan, or, you know, and motherhood in Haiti is very different motherhood. So I would pin down and narrow down on this one singular and particular person, mother person, that you are writing about, and try to inhabit as much as you can that very particular character, yeah. and how she deals with her experience of motherhood.
Yeah. Okay, next question. Can you remind me of the recent movie you starred in that took place in New York? I saw so many characters and themes from other books, particularly The Dew Breakers, a strong movie.
So I was in a movie that this person saw. Thank you for going, you and 10 others. It was my friend Patricia Benoit, who's a wonderful filmmaker, who's like my macumé, like my, I'm the godmother of her child, she's the godmother of my child, and she wrote a film called Wash Na Soleil, Stones in the Sun, mm-hmm. and it's also a collage assembly of different characters, but in the film is set in that period between 1986 and 1990, and 1986 was the end of the Duvalier dictatorship, when Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, left, and then 1990, when you had the first democratically elected President Aristide. So it was in the time of the generals, she says, mm-hmm. and like when you had these juntas who were the transitional power, and the repression was still going, mm-hmm. and all these characters left Haiti and then moved to New York. Mm-hmm. And so you had, and very interestingly, you had also this, the one of the central relationships was a father and son. The father, who had been a big makut, one of the Duvalier's henchmen, left, was driven out of Haiti, and he had no choice but to go to his son, who was in New York, who was an activist against the dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so they had to come to some kind of peace. And there was also a couple who was married, and the husband had to flee and left his wife, and she was brutally raped during that time. And then my character was coming to New York to join her sister. She was a community activist, but a college professor, mm-hmm. And her sister in New York was sort of a real estate glamour gal. And they had to bend their relationship. And so I was definitely, it was that an amateur actor situation. But it was, you know, they say with amateur actors, you get someone to play themselves. And so I felt like she thought I was playing myself, and it, it went okay.
What was the name? What was the name of the movie again?
Wash na Soleil, Stones in the Sun, and it's not been distributed. It's been in festivals. It premiered in a Tribeca Film Festival, okay. And it was just at this weekend in the New Orleans Film Festival. So it's sort of been making the festival rounds. Have you tried to écrire en français ou en créole? I haven't tried to write, definitely. En français and French, what I used to write were letters to my parents when they were in New York. And I used to write these letters, and they were very formulaic. It was like, bonjour maman, bonjour papa, comment ça va, on est bien grâce à Dieu. And it was always starting like that. And they would write almost the same way, you know, bonjour chérie. And so that was really my experience of writing in French. I never thought I could creative write in French. And if you counter that with also the people we were taught to read, I was taught to read in French, were sort of the big French, you know, Voltaire, Hugo, and I thought, wow. And at that time, we weren't taught to write in Creole. So I learned to write in Creole as an adult, and we had done some of the stories in Cricrac, for example, as radio plays for Radio Haïti, and I did some of those translations myself. So I feel like, I mean, English is probably, sometimes people think it's a choice, it's a commercial choice, but it's sort of kind of at 12, I came to English and I started writing in it. I always cite this, and I always think of it, of the epigraph in Junot Diaz's Drown, where it's by a Cuban poet, where he says, the fact that I'm writing this to you in English possibly falsifies what I'm saying to you, mm-hmm. but I don't belong to, maybe I don't belong to English, but I don't belong anywhere else. So it's mm-hmm. kind of, I think that's sort of the dilemma of people like him and me, that we came to English and that became sort of the language we write in, even though we speak the other languages. But I always think ultimately, and maybe it grows from my own reality, that language is a tool. Mm. And you use the tool that is at your disposal, that seems to be, you know, how it comes. And
yeah. Is your writing influenced by Joel Chandler Harris's Uncle Remus, the sayings and songs of Briar Rabbit?
I'm definitely aware of those stories, mm-hmm. and I think there's definitely parallel structures. I mean, in those stories, Zora Neale Hurston did a great job of, you know, bridging those things in books, mm-hmm. in the books that she wrote about Haiti, and in the South. And I think she more than anybody sort of tried to put those parallels. So she tells the story, I think, in Tell My Horse, where she tells some of the Southern stories, but she also tells the story of this president, I forget which Haitian president, who had a full funeral mass for his goat. And and draws sort of the parallels between that and sort of Southern Gothic and things like that. So I think they're definitely similar structures mm-hmm. in these stories, and mm-hmm. Brer Rabbit is a lot like a character in Haitian folklore, Timalis. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much like, those stories are very much Tar Baby and Brer, very much like Buki and Malis, who are very similar characters in Haitian folklore.
Mm-hmm. Another question. I saw you in a very powerful film. I guess it's another Stones in the Water.
Wow, a lot of you guys
went to another person.
Stones in the Sun, not the water. Actually, it's very funny you said Stones in the Water, because the full proverb is wash na d'l'eau, pas qu'on misère wash na soleil. Stones in the water don't know the misery of stones in the sun. Ah. And there's actually a character who says that in the film, the radio journalist who is the son of the Makut says that in the film.
Mm. Well, do you have any plans to have your most recent or earlier books made into a film, into film? And which of your books do you think would translate the best onto the screen? And if not you, who would you choose to do the screenplay?
I don't think I would ever do a screenplay of one of my books. I used to work in film, so you lose your illusions about things actually getting made because it's such a long and hard years process, and you can come very close and it not happen. So, but I feel like once I'm done with some material, it's very hard to go back and like to have recraft it, except the stuff we did for Haitian Radio, which was of course a special privilege. I don't know which one of those books would make a good movie. I think it would be hard to for a lot of them, because a lot of them happen sort of in people's heads and things like that. I don't know, but I've had the honor really of sometimes having young filmmakers, young Haitian American filmmakers who want to do some of the like as student films. Like someone did a student film with The Missing Piece and Creek Crack, which is a short story. So things like that, but I don't really know.
Well, let's see. In Jonathan Katie's book.
Do you want me to?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm challenged.
Okay, in Jonathan Katz's book, The Big Truck That Went By, he concludes that Haiti is indifferent to what you want to get from it. In light of all the missionary groups and NGOs who daily arrive in Haiti, how would you respond to this comment? Haiti is indifferent to what you want to get from it. I don't know. I guess I would have to ask him to elaborate. I mean, I guess the essence of what he's trying to say is that, which is something that I think people who have observed Haiti for a long time understand too, is that no matter how much people try to change Haiti to their image, I think it's got a very strong resistance to that, because there's a very strong sense of identity, a very strong sense of culture and sovereignty there, and it's probably what from the beginning others have most resented and resisted about Haiti, from people trying to, from the Catholic Church cutting down trees and anti-superstition campaigns to the recent groups that sort of trading food for faith, etc. There's something like a friend of mine calls maronage, so there's something very protective, I think, about the Haitian soul that will survive ultimately all of these attempts. You don't have to do everyone, will you?
I actually want to. When was the last time you visited Haiti?
I was there in July. We go in the summer often to see my mother-in-law, but I'm also involved in this cinema school in Jacmel called Cine Institute, and it's a wonderful project where you have young filmmakers, and now they have an audio school where they, so you have these young people in Jacmel who are making films. Mm. And the films are amazing. There's a couple who've done features, but they do mostly short films. And so at the end of the year, a couple of us go and, you know, and we watch the films and talk to them and about stories. But it's so, you know, it's just like, I'm writing something about it now for a paper, but just being in the middle of this place, watching films that these young people have made and they're, and who are, you know, who have been in many ways, by their admissions, so assaulted about different images about themselves, and now get this opportunity to make films about their own reality. And so the last time I was there, we were doing that, working with a group of young filmmakers.
It brings back the theme again of when the radio host Bernard in your story, Bernard and Luis, people who invite people to tell their stories on the radio. And so it seems like this is what is happening, allowing people to take a camera and to show from their own perspective.
Oh, and I think that's so, that's what's so powerful about also the new media and all these things that exist, and in the sense that even, you know, with the earthquake, the night of the earthquake, we saw that. Usually you would have sat there and just watched only others, you know, the foreign journalists go and tell the story. But now you had people who, you had young people who did their blogs. There was a young woman blogging from a tent city. There's more possibilities now, I think, to hear directly from people as to what happened to them. And young people, those who have access to these media, really can share their stories with the world. They don't have to, you know, go, all of them don't have to go through the foreign correspondents. You know, there's more and more possibilities for them to speak directly to us about their reality. So I think that's one of the positive developments. And also with the growing group too of younger Haitian American writers, younger Haitian American scholars, the journalists that we've had now, young Haitian American journalists who report on their own community at the same time as other communities. So I think part of that that's been important. That's something that didn't exist when I was 12. But that as we are growing as a community, that there's just more ways to hear directly from people about their experiences, be it their experiences in Haiti or their experiences in the diaspora. And then the people in the diaspora can sometimes act as a kind of a bridge also, because we're also listening for those stories, in a way that wasn't possible before, that you can go directly now to the source.
That sounds incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Edward Chandicott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.